from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, Governor Gretchen Whitmer delivers her third State of the State address after a year filled with crisis after crisis.
I know you're used to me saying, fix the damn roads. This year, let's also fix the damn road ahead. Let's find common ground to grow our economy, get families and businesses back on their feet.
We'll have analysis of her speech. Also, some reaction from a Republican lawmaker about Whitmer's calls for bipartisanship.
It's been a message of waiting for the next announcement and open-ended restrictions, which is just destroying the morale of people in our state.
Plus, a big political shakeup could be coming as legislative boundaries are redrawn. And yes, you can get involved.
This is the time for public participation.
Those stories coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's getting a brand new set of congressional boundaries this year, and the voter-approved commission created to take politics out of the process is facing some unusual hurdles and hopes to hear from you.
Here's your chance to advocate for yourself. And this is what the commission needs to know. It needs to know what interests you share, you know, with your neighbors. You know, what interests do you want to be represented in Lansing or Washington, D.C.?
Later in the show, we'll catch up with where the process stands. But first, we're going to recap what Governor Whitmer had to say in her annual State of the State speech.
This past year, we confronted historic, converging crises, a worldwide pandemic, the recession it caused, a 500-year flooding event, a nationwide call against racial inequity, and a deeply divisive election. And together, we took action.
This was the first time in living memory that a Michigan governor delivered the speech in a place other than before a full legislative audience at the Capitol. She spoke this year from her formal office in the state's Capitol building, but obviously without lawmakers in attendance. Stateside's Laura Weber Davis and Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta teamed up for our coverage last night, and we have them now. Rick, Laura, hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Gretchen Whitmer has done it again, delivering another State of the State in something like a 30-minute window. She's really breaking all the school records for speed, isn't she, Rick?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. That it can take longer to deliver a pizza than it took her to deliver the State of the State.
That sounds like the voice of experience. Well, the theme that Whitmer kept repeating last night was a positive vision for Michigan's future and unity among partisans.
And I'll continue to reach out to Republicans here in Lansing. While common ground seems less and less common these days, it's never been more important that we work toward it.
The governor has been at odds with Michigan's Republican legislative leaders on just about every issue over the past 12 months. Rick, do you think that last night's State of the State read to Republicans like an olive branch?
An olive branch, yes. A breakthrough, no. That Republican leaders talked both last night and today about what they heard and the way that they heard it. And it was, yeah, you know, those are nice words, but we need that to be followed up by actions and collaboration. And they say the time has passed for the governor to continue using emergency management processes to move quickly. And they want to be in the room to help develop those policies. And at odds with the administration, they want to reopen more quickly sectors of the economy, schools, things like that. And they still feel like they have not been heard.
I suppose we should note that maybe the Republican legislative leadership wasn't exactly the audience that Gretchen Whitmer had in mind. Laura, do you think she was speaking to people like Mike Shirkey, or was she speaking to a different audience?
It's so hard to say. For me, it was very interesting how different her tone was last night than I think we've heard over the past year, as there has been this deep infighting between her office and the legislative leaders on the Republican side of the aisle. And, you know, last night was overtly bipartisan and unifying in tone. And the Republicans have been saying, rightfully so, that she has thrown politics into some of her messages around COVID-19 or, say, the storming of the Capitol last spring, where they felt like they were being put on guard unnecessarily by the governor. And so this messaging last night seemed vastly different from that. And so I couldn't tell if she was actually trying to talk to them or if she was trying to tell Michiganders beyond them that this is what I want. I want a unifying message. I want unity going forward with Republicans. And so I wasn't really sure if that unifying message that seemed to be bipartisan tone was actually aimed in a bipartisan capacity.
Okay. Well, if I could jump in here. Speeches like this are often directed to multiple audiences at the same time. And I think that Laura is absolutely right in that respect, that the governor tried to strike a different tone than what we've heard in her other public appearances dealing with the legislature. She didn't say things like, you know, having to be the adult in the room, that she's trying to take down the temperature. And I suspect, without any real insider knowledge, that that was directed both at Republicans in the legislature, if not to create cooperation up front, to at least set the stage for that to happen at some point, and also to persuade the public that, in fact, she is trying to come up with a multilateral approach to dealing with COVID-19 and reopening the economy and education and all of that, and not just go it alone.
So in terms of just Gretchen Whitmer saying what she wants to do within the next year, did you hear any pivots in how she's been approaching the multiple crises of the moment?
I would say no. I think that she's sticking very much to the same path that she's been on in terms of things like permanently increasing the minimum wage, doing things to lure more people into high-tech professions, you know, that sort of thing. And those are things that she's been focused on since the beginning of her administration. She's making the argument now that the fact that we're living in COVID, and she's also looking ahead, we should point out, to what life in Michigan might be like post-COVID by doubling down on some of these things that she's called for already.
Let's talk a little bit about reaction to the speech. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky said repeatedly, including on Michigan Radio's Morning Edition, that the most important thing about Whitmer's speech last night to him was that she delivered it without wearing a mask. Let's listen.
What stood out to me the most was not what she said, but what she did. And what she did was she talked to us without a mask. It's not that I'm saying masks are evil, but symbols and gestures matter. And I think it was a great opportunity for her to help us move from this notion of fear and control into a trust and hope mode.
Shirky also said in almost the same breath that Whitmer looked great. Laura, did we not just have a big conversation about how women leaders are under a different lens? Like, did my memory fail? Did that not just happen a few short months ago?
If not a few short months ago, this is a conversation we've been having for years. I mean, ever since women have really been able to rise to prominence in these major statewide and nationally elected positions, I think that we're talking about it a lot more, about how often we do hear these comments. And, you know, Mike Shirky comes from an era where that seems like a compliment and is something innocuous and kind. And he's looking for nice things to say about his relationship or about the governor, about his relationship with the governor or about her in general, because they have not had a great public relationship. So to him, this is a compliment, and he's trying to find places to compliment her. Unfortunately, the breadth and scope of the compliments he feels like he can issue for her have to do with her physical appearance. And I'm not sure he recognizes how offensive that is to women broadly, and probably specifically to Governor Whitmer, who has weathered this type of language around her appearance for her entire career. So it's not new to her, but that doesn't mean it's any less hurtful. So I would say that he's not going to change, and neither is she. So, you know, it's more just about the public outrage that it creates.
Maybe the message for Mike Shirky is either tie your shoes and stop tripping over your shoelaces, or buy a nice pair of loafers.
Rick, I wonder, just putting aside, you know, some of the inadvertent messaging, what this says in terms of Republican priorities. I mean, amid all the other challenges facing state government right now, Mike Shirkey is saying people need to see unmasked faces. Is that the note that you think the rest of the Republican leadership in Lansing wanted to hit?
I think that's a great point that you're making there, April. Whether it was intentional or not, that this, you know, kerfuffle over Mike Shirkey talking about how the governor looks without a mask is almost symbolic of the way that the governor and the legislature's Republican leaders are almost talking past each other rather than to each other.
Yeah. Gretchen Whitmer says that she wants unity. Rick, where will she have a chance to work on it in the weeks to come?
Well, you know, they're trying to identify some spaces that the governor alluded back to, some sentencing reform work that there was bipartisan agreement on. And she said in the speech that she wants to tap back into that spirit of cooperation. And Republican leaders said they welcome that. They just haven't seen any evidence of it to date. And one example of it is that when they get into a room with the governor's staff to talk about the COVID response, they feel like they're getting lectures on what's going to happen and not a conversation on how it might proceed. And, you know, maybe the evidence of whether or not the relationship is changing will be the word we get on how those meetings are arranged, who's in them, and whether or not Republicans feel like this is a dialogue or a monologue. Plus, just what we see, you know, coming down in the future in terms of using the public health orders that the governor says are so important to being nimble enough to meet the COVID crisis as it evolves and changes.
Rick Pluta reports on all things Lansing for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and Laura Weber Davis is the executive producer of Stateside. Laura, Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
In just a moment, we get some Republican response to this speech with a representative from Owosso.
Anything that could actually define what we're looking at as success would take away a lot of the tension that's out there and a lot of the cynicism that's out there. People need to see the plan, and the plan needs to be better defined.
We'll hear his thoughts after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Gretchen Whitmer's message last night may have been one of unity and bipartisanship, but her relationships with Republicans in the state legislature, especially during the pandemic, have been fraught. Here with a look at the governor's performance on the job from across the aisle is Ben Frederick. He's a Republican state representative from Owosso. Representative Frederick, welcome to Stateside.
I'm very glad to join you. Thank you.
Governor Whitmer seemed to be interested in striking a positive tone for 2021 in her speech. What did you think of how she focused it?
Well, obviously, I'm always appreciative of any mention of bipartisanship. I was honored to be mentioned for a second year in a row by the governor for work that we had done in a bipartisan nature. The proof will really be in the actions that are taken, because what we've seen from the administration, unfortunately, is that bipartisan is welcome on just their terms. And the most pressing issue before our state, COVID, and how we respond to COVID and the myriad challenges that have come from COVID, that has seemed to be an area that has had no interest in partnership as far as the governor is concerned.
The context in which she mentioned you was your work on the bipartisan Michigan Reconnect program. So for folks who hadn't heard of this before, it's tuition-free job training and community college for adults who are looking to get some post-secondary certification. Do you think that there are other issues where there's room for bipartisan work in the coming year, given how deeply divided things feel right now?
Well, I think there certainly is. I mean, I think, you know, again, under the construction of our state government, the laws are initiated and money is appropriated by the legislature. The laws are administered by the executive departments. They're interpreted by the courts. Anything we do in government has an expectation of, you know, moving across the branches of government. So as we've looked in the past on things, whether it's workforce development, as Reconnect was a piece of, economic development, criminal justice reform, auto insurance reform. We've seen that we can tackle big issues in a bipartisan way, which is what makes it so frustrating to be in a situation of where there isn't that balance and where legislators like myself feel that we have a diminished voice on behalf of our constituents when it comes to the administration of our COVID response strategies, which do involve consideration of many, as I say, myriad policies and how those policies affect people who are hurting in a lot of ways across the state. There's certainly avenues for bipartisanship.
There's a bit of a classic conflict here between executive function and legislative oversight, but I'm just curious what you mean when you talk about, you know, the COVID rules and what's not happening.
Well, I think the best illustration I can give you is the conduct of the administration prior to April 30th, where we had some back and forth conversations on executive orders and so on. Back then, as I stated publicly, I was not averse to the idea of executive order administration, emergency authority, especially in those emerging weeks. And we were able to do certain things to influence order administration based upon the feedback of our constituents. It had some early successes with definitions, with some of the rules that were coming down, clarity on those things. When we started to reach an impasse where the governor was asserting in effect that she didn't need to have that ongoing dialogue, we saw all of that feedback and all of that interaction with the executive agencies cease. And at the time, I had 20 inquiries from my district in, including several from health partners like our local hospital system, public health, those that we would ask to administer these things, looking for clarity. And their voices were diminished as a part of that process. So from a functional standpoint, there's a role for the legislature. Obviously, you can go into different policy disagreements on some of the things now, the lack of clarity on benchmarks for reestablishing hospitality, the need for further precise attention to things like remediation. Special education is particularly close to my heart, seeing some of the challenges that my own children have had as special needs students. So it's everywhere, and it's why people have an elected legislature to interact with that executive, particularly 10 months into what has been declared a statewide emergency. I think we can start to see some of that collaboration, and it would make sense to have that collaboration.
Governor Whitmer proposed last night vaccinating 70% of the population that's over the age of 16 this year, and she's aiming at 50,000 vaccinations a day. There is the matter of whether or not that many doses are available from the makers, but will the legislature provide the funding that's needed to make that happen?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to be getting vaccinated as soon as it's appropriate to do so. And we already had submitted $50 million for the practical administration of vaccine funding. That first block of money has not been fully expended yet. And you'll see that certainly on the logistical side, keeping in mind that the actual purchase of vaccines and so on is handled by the federal government. We really move toward the logistical apparatus for deployment in the state with state resources. But it won't be simply handed over. There's going to need to be some transparency on how these things are done. I've had very good feedback from my, again, local health partners, my local hospital system, as to some of the logistical challenges with forecasting inventories, the need for more transparency from the state agency, and so on. But obviously, I think it's a worthy goal, and it needs to be done, that we get that done. But there is a natural process of appropriations accountability with executive agencies, as you've had with any type of appropriations process.
Governor Whitmer also said she wants to spend $5.6 billion, most of it in the form of federal money, to help schools. We've heard the leadership saying that local control of those funds will be important. What does that mean for you? What are your concerns?
Well, in talking about bipartisanship, I think it's important to remember that we did pass a bipartisan school reengagement plan. And it spoke to local control. So it created a kind of unique circumstance where the governor has asserted executive order authority for many, many parts of the economy and life. But in this case of schools, the visioning was to be determined by the local districts. And I think that that needs to be honored as we move forward, that we continue to have the administration of education as a key community priority that is determined more by local prevailing conditions than by a statewide one-size-fits-all type of restriction. So moving ahead, yes, it's important that that funding is there for re-engagement, particularly remediation, as we look at what students, some of whom have been out of the classroom for 10 months, what that means for their development, and elevating education to a place of supremacy in our community priorities, which I believe is always going to have more practical energy being directed at the local level.
You mentioned that your own kids have some special education needs. Would you mind sharing some of your experience as a parent during the pandemic and what you've observed as schools have tried to adjust?
Yeah, we've had a tremendous blessing in our area with the strong ISD program for my daughter and a wonderfully administered program through local district for my son, different parts of the autism spectrum. My wife is on sabbatical as a behavior analyst, a board certified behavior analyst. So we had that additional opportunity for them to receive that type of therapeutic aid. But my wife is also not a teacher. And it became immediately apparent to us, as I know it is with so many parents, just absolutely reminding us the value of our educators and what they're doing for our kids. We have seen the challenges that particularly face special education delivery. There's been a valiant effort to try to translate as much as possible to the delivery online, but it's very tough, particularly with kids that have very short attention spans, to translate that information. My son's had difficulty, of course, you know, staying attentive to his instruction, getting frustrated. And we certainly can feel the stress on the part of our educational professionals. And we also, though, have all seen this desire to get in our area, to get kids in person as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and understanding the social, emotional needs of these children. Now, in my own case, in particular with autism, the need to actually have that exchange, that social exchange, is so important for our kids. Now, for all kids, particularly special needs kids, where they have to learn social language. They have to have that practical exchange with other students. And I definitely started to notice some behavioral spikes and different changes over the course of months with my son. And I think it puts a lot of burden on parents across our state, as they certainly want to see their children succeed. And they have stresses themselves as well. We had the ability to have my wife be home with them. I know that's a very difficult option, if an option at all for a lot of families.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is State Representative Ben Frederick of Owosso. We're talking a little bit about the governor's State of the State address and related issues in state government right now. You know, the governor called for unity last night. To this point, I guess in 2020 mostly, a great deal of messaging from Democrats in the legislature and in the administration has been about stopping the spread of COVID, stopping it from harming or killing even more people in Michigan. And a lot of Republican messaging has focused on the economic damage of the moment and making sure that we have a way to come back from this. What do you think the majority in the Michigan House has to offer toward reconciling those two goals?
Well, I think that there's acknowledgement that you obviously have to take COVID-19 seriously. I certainly do. And that it has to be something that is addressed and addressed aggressively and addressed smartly. At the same time, when the entire apparatus of the government is moving toward one particular goal, the silent victims are often not heard. We have to be practical about what types of risks we should assume in this environment and what type of risks are truly things that we should say, okay, this is too risky in this situation. There are certain things that to me and to many people in Michigan, I believe, are still worth having some of a risk assessment kind of calculation, like whether they see their loved ones at end of life or not. Is there a way to structure that safely? Is there true value in shutting down the economy by fiat and then declaring victory at some point and having nothing left to reopen? There has to be a practical reality of that. And the idea is, do we reach a point where we talk about what is truly safe and what is unsafe? And what decisions, what personal utility do people themselves in their own decision-making have in this equation? I don't like the idea of being told to be in a defensive crouch and staying home and waiting for further orders and instructions. I think we have to charge the people of Michigan with some personal responsibility to make assessments and make decisions as well. So there is a balance there. And I think that's the type of balance that is informing many of the legislature's proposals.
What has the new House Speaker, Jason Wentworth, been focusing on in the first couple of weeks?
Well, our initial first piece of legislation had to do with trying to restore trust in government, talking about practical needs for government transparency and government accountability, ethics reform, things that would allow that faith to be restored in government. And also, practically speaking, being attentive and responsive to what we're hearing from people that we represent, and putting the legislature in a position where we really can be effective voices for that process. I think that that's a welcome message. I've come to know the speaker over the years, a very honorable man as a former veteran, and just a very disciplined person and a very forthright person. And he has been seeking to engage and meet with the governor and find areas of common ground. And I know he's genuine in that.
You know, Governor Whitmer says that the Republican leadership has not been present at updates on metrics around COVID. Do you think that's something that Speaker Wentworth would consider?
Well, I know that it just isn't the case, frankly, because I've been invited to a number of these calls, and I participated in a number of these data calls and metric calls. I was the author of the initial ongoing response proposal last fall that talked about restoring some degree of certainty and hope. And I was invited to some of the data calls, but you know, there wasn't that invitation wasn't extended for several months. And I was able to participate in a number of the calls, but you know, at the same time, you know, when you go into some of these processes, it takes two people to have a conversation. Now I can very well read a briefing after a call that tells me what is going to be decided. I'm more interested in having conversations that actually involve conversation. I'm not really interested in having conversations that are one-sided, where a person just restating what's already been done or what's already been decided. And I think that's kind of the disconnect there. What the governor considers to be conversational or collaborative conversations, to me, are one way. And we do have members participating on those calls every week, so that's not accurate that that's not happening. But they haven't been of tremendous value from the aspect of, you know, building that relationship or any type of practical forum for providing input.
What are you hoping that Governor Whitmer will focus on with the legislature right now?
Well, in this case, for me, I think that the best thing that the governor could do is acknowledge the need for injecting some certainty and hope into this COVID response strategy, because anything that could actually define what we're looking at as success would take away a lot of the tension that's out there and a lot of the cynicism that's out there. People need to see the plan, and the plan needs to be better defined. And that's very much crystallized in things like the school athletic situation, where many other states have protocols for safely reengaging athletics. That comes to mind for the restaurant restrictions, which are very severe as they reopen, even as those restaurants have done a ton of stuff to be safe and so on. And then the overall re-engagement strategy, which we've moved away from, the phased engagement strategy of the phases of, you know, fourth phase, five phase, six phase, you know, we've lost sight even of the governor's initial planning. So we're in this ether of this pause. And so if there is a desire to come together, there has to be an acknowledgement that certainty and hope is worth putting in some hard lines to say, this is what we're going to define as success. We're going to have these measures for public health benchmarks. And I understand that if things evolve further, you may have to change some of those things, but then we can have a conversation as a community. Right now, we've been governing by wait for the next announcement.
We should say that the governor has really no way to predict how many vaccine doses are going to be available at any given point. There's a fair amount of chaos at the level of where the doses have been coming from. And if the governor's in a situation where she can't say exactly how many doses each county is going to be getting, and she really can't force people to wear masks, how much of a plan and how much predictability can she provide?
Well, I think that the fact is, again, you're ejecting some personal responsibility in that. I was the mayor of my hometown during the recession and recovery years. And when you set a goal and you let people know why the goal is there, you actually start to see people responding and making choices. If we had a certain positivity level we had a certain ICU capacity that was hardline, that these restrictions go into place if our hospital capacity drops below this requirement. That affects behavior. And I don't think there's really ever been that trust level that personal utility has anything to account in these situations. It's been more, by restriction, trusting the restrictions more than trusting a person's ability to look at it as a thinking adult and adapt behavior. That's really, I think, a difference in approach that's quite profound. I mean, that I have with the governor. I do have a level of trust in people's ability as thinking adults to respond to defined targets with, the public health underpinning that. And I think that you would see a better result as well.
Ben Frederick represents the 85th District in Shiawassee County and some of Saginaw County, too. Representative Frederick, thank you for taking some time with us.
I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Coming up, what's happening with the state's Independent Redistricting Committee? Committee members won't get key census data for another 6 or 7 months. So what to do in the meantime?
This is the time for public participation.
We'll talk to folks in charge of that effort next. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. At this hour, the Independent Commission redrawing new legislative district boundaries for Michigan is holding a public meeting. They're talking about procedural rules, hearing presentations on voting rights and other issues. The commission's work concerns new maps for both state and federal offices. Its mission is to reverse partisan gerrymandering. Politically speaking, this is a big deal. Our state could end up losing or gaining a seat in Congress, and it might mean some shifts in the state legislature as well. With us today are Sue Hammersmith, Executive Director of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. She does not have a vote, but helps keep the commission's business moving along. And also Nancy Wong, Executive Director of Voters Not Politicians. That's the nonprofit that campaigned to help make this change possible in state procedures. Sue, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Sue, you were just appointed in December. Can you tell us a little bit about what things have been like and how the pandemic has affected the work of the commission?
The pandemic has resulted in all our meetings being virtual, and so I've only met people on a computer. However, I do feel like I know the commissioners, and I'm really amazed at how respectful they are of each other and how committed they are to the mission of the redistricting so that it will be fair and non-partial.
Yeah. Can you give us an idea of what goes on in the meetings?
Typically, we start out with opportunities for public comment. We welcome anybody from the public to sign up through the Secretary of State website in the Redistricting Michigan section. And they can speak to the commission if they choose to speak. So we get reports from the executive director and legal counsel. So the staff is reporting on the work they're doing in between meetings. And then we get into the heart of the business. So it may be approving an RFP for a consultant of some kind that the commission needs. We're working on rules of procedure. Budget, anything to do with the administrative role of this commission at this time.
I think I assumed back in early 2020, before we knew what was going to happen, that this would be a very closely followed process and that a lot of the public would be very interested in what's going on. You know, it's a first of its kind moment for Michigan. Have a lot of people been attending the meetings virtually?
There have been people attending meetings. We'd love to have more. Again, everything we do is through open meetings. So it's there out in the public for anybody to see. And we really welcome people to get engaged with us in any way, whether it's attending meetings and only watching or whether they want to give public comment. We welcome that citizen participation. That's why citizen is in the name.
Yeah. Nancy Wong, the group that you lead, Voters Not Politicians, helped set this in motion by campaigning to pass Proposal 2. What's it like seeing where the commission is now getting started?
It's thrilling, really. You were asking about, you know, whether the public was interested in attending these commission meetings. And I will say that voters, not politicians, volunteers, you know, many of us have been attending every single commission meeting. And we've been marveling at, you know, the kind of realization of our vision, really the Michigan Public's vision, of this really transparent citizen-led process that is, you know, fair, impartial. It puts voters first and at the center of redistricting, which of course is completely opposite of what we had before with gerrymandering. So, and we're looking forward to this last, part where we really get community members to come and give their input and, you know, where we start the map making process.
Nancy, I'm going to ask you this question, but Sue, if you'd like to chime in, please do. I wondered if you could explain what information is needed to understand where the new districts will be drawn. What is the basis for what the commission is going to be making its decisions?
Right. So this process that's citizen-led, you know, by our 13-member Citizens Commission, their task under the Constitution is to draw election districts for the state of Michigan, you know, our state legislative and congressional districts, in a way that really reflects the diversity of the state and respects communities of interest. And what that means is, you know, we are, again, we're changing the way our maps are drawn from what they were, you know, how they were drawn before, which was, you know, politicians and behind closed doors getting together and really actually splitting our communities whenever they needed to for partisan benefit, you know, when they needed to really, you know, take, if you had a certain group that tended to vote Democratic, for example, the Republicans in power would really intentionally split up that group in order that, you know, to dilute their voting power. And here it is completely the opposite process. So the commission has to take into account and preserve, you know, these communities where they exist in order that they can vote when they have a shared interest, be it, you know, economic or cultural, and so that they can elect the representative of their choice. But the commission, of course, isn't going to know where the boundaries of all of our existing communities are. So that's where all of the education and public outreach that groups like Voters Not Politicians and other nonprofits, good government groups like League of Women Voters and Michigan Nonprofit Association are really trying to get the word out. We're doing widespread statewide public outreach to tell communities, hey, here's your chance to advocate for yourself. And this is what the commission needs to know. It needs to know what interests you share, you know, with your neighbors. What makes you a community? Is it, you know, economic? Are you rural? Are you a farming community? You know, what interests do you want to be represented in Lansing or Washington, D.C.? You know, what makes it so that you should be kept together when you're voting? And they need to know, you know, what interests you have, and then also where the boundaries are of your community. So, you know, does it go past this highway? You know, does it go, you know, this far north? What are your kind of landmarks that identify, you know, where your community should lie and not be broken up? And it needs to have that information in a way that's kind of actionable. So we've learned from commissions in other states that, like California, that what's really helpful for a commission is to actually have a map. You know, you can draw it on Google Maps, you can draw it using, you know, software, but an actual showing of, you know, here are the roads and here are the boundaries of our community. And then the commission really could use, you know, testimony from community members, again, explaining, like, why did you, you know, submit this map and why are you advocating for these particular boundaries?
A key source for the information that the committee needs is the U.S. Census. And we know now that the census may not deliver some of the demographic information, a great amount of the demographic information that's needed until July. There's a September 17th deadline that the commission is working with, Sue. How are you structuring what to do with your time in the interim when, you know, there's just these months and months before those critical numbers come in?
Oh, well, we just heard today that the census data that is really detailed may not come until the end of July. So this is going to really make the month of August busy. Again, after we have initial maps drawn, we have to have five public hearings on top of the 10 before we draw any maps. So we'll just have to have everything in place so we're ready to go. It's going to be very tight on the timelines, but these are mandated in the Constitution, and the commission will meet the timelines.
Nancy, do you worry that the issues with the census, partly caused by the pandemic and partly because of a top-down effort from the Trump administration to move, hurry things along, do you worry that that's still in keeping with what the voters approved when they approved this process? I mean, would voters, not politicians, support any alteration of the timeline?
I'm not concerned. You know, the way, and we would not support an extension of the constitutional deadline. And the reason is because the way the process is set up, you know, most of the commission's work really comes, you know, a bulk of it, you know, really can be done and should be done before we ever get the census data. So there's a large education and outreach component. And like I said, you know, groups like Voters Not Politicians is, we're really, you know, focusing on that for our 2021 work. And the commission's job is really to listen to these communities and to understand, okay, where are your boundaries? What are your interests? You know, to have the commission, the communities understand that there should be this kind of transparent exchange of information, and that it's not just a one-time, you know, we deliver testimony. It should be an ongoing conversation. And all of that can be done without census data, without the final 2020 census data. And in fact, if the commission wants to demonstrate, for example, how maps will be drawn and how, you know, this data will be incorporated in the maps, then there is interim census data. There's the American Community Survey that comes out of the U.S. Census Bureau, and that's available for 2018, 2019. So there is data. You could even plug in, you know, 2010 census data just to demonstrate for the public, okay, this is what that process will look like. And then once you get the census data, of course, you know, at that point, the commission will be drafting the maps, and then there's going to be another round of really intense, you know, public engagement, because of course that's when the rubber meets the road and people understand, you know, what's at stake, what are the potential like districts going to look like. But again, I think if we've done all of our, you know, collective work and have the public really involved up to that point, I think everyone really will be prepared to undertake that exercise. And then the commission has between, you know, end of July, say August, to November 1st, in order to finalize, you know, the district maps for the state of Michigan. So I think if the process really proceeds, and if the commission, you know, does come out with a schedule of commission, you know, hearings in the next several months to kind of, you know, start the outreach, then I think we're going to proceed just fine, and we'll end up with fair maps and a really, you know, a process that took in a lot of public input, and that's what was intended. And I think we'll really achieve that.
Sue, can you give us a sense of how confident you are that the commission can deliver something that will be acceptable to the voters?
Well, I think the commitment of the commission is to deliver fair, nonpartisan redistricting for our state that benefits all citizens. So are we going to make everybody happy? Certainly not. We are very committed, and I will tell you, I've heard it from every commissioner, the commitment that they are committed to making this a fair, nonpartisan process where the citizens of Michigan are taken into first consideration with the redistricting maps.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Sue Hammersmith. She's a member of Michigan's Independent Citizen Redistricting Commission. And we're also talking with Nancy Wong, the executive director of Voters Not Politicians. That's the group that ran the campaign that encouraged voters to consider this form of nonpartisan redistricting as a change to the way Michigan had been doing it for decades. I wanted to ask Nancy if we could take a minute to talk about what Voters Not Politicians has been working on now that you're sort of out of the redistricting commission discussion. I understand the group's been advocating for a number of reforms, including open records acts that would cover both the governor's office and the legislature. Can you tell us about what these are meant to achieve?
Sure. Well, you know, ensuring the success of the commission, of course, that is our number one priority. And we are doing a lot of public outreach around that. But, you know, we are also prioritizing getting ethics and transparency and accountability reforms through our legislature this year. And the reason for that and the urgency for that is really, you know, in response to, we've all seen the sustained disinformation and attempts to delegitimize our election. And I think that's done real damage to our democracy in the state and weakened our institutions. So there's an urgent need for us to bring, you know, transparency and accountability to our legislature in order to restore people's trust in our government so that, you know, they can work and solve the real problems that are facing, you know, facing Michiganders of across the political spectrum. And so things like open records laws, you know, closing the revolving door between legislators and lobbyists, you know, having clear conflicts of interest laws, these should not be controversial. In fact, with some of these, it's like 48 out of the 50 states have them already. They're very basic. And so, you know, we need to get them in place. And, you know, there's bipartisan support. We're encouraged to see, and we're really confident that we can do this year.
Nancy, when there's a bit of a divide in how folks from different parties talk about these issues. When Democrats talk about accountability, they may be talking about the influence of money in politics. They may be talking about bolstering people's faith in their elected officials and knowing that elections are free and fair. And when Republicans talk about these issues, they may focus on some of the public health measures that have been taken on in the past 12 months, or they may be repeating claims about elections that have been proven to be untrue. Is it possible to craft the kind of legislation that you would like to see passed when the two sides kind of mean different things when they come to the topic?
Right. You know, I think it is possible because you're looking at the root cause for the public, you know, the voters' perspective of distrust in government. I think it comes from a fundamental lack of transparency, right? We want to know what's influencing our elected officials. You know, is it money? Is it special interest? You know, open records laws goes to that, right? It we can request records, like I said, as 48 other states allow voters to do, that allow us to see, okay, who did you meet with? You know, where did you get this draft bill from? You know, why are you acting in the way? Do you have a direct financial interest in seeing this bill pass that you've been really strongly advocating for? You know, those are the kinds of things that are just very basic and allow the voters to hold our elected officials accountable in the sense that, hey, if you're not working in our interests, especially with these fair maps we'll have in place now, you know, we get to vote you out. So that's really what I'm thinking about when I think about accountability. You know, what are our lawmakers doing? Whose interests are they working toward? And if it's not the voters, then we have the power to vote them out.
The Michigan House is considering rules that put a check on lame duck sessions and lawmaker conflict of interests. And I think House Speaker Jason Wentworth is introducing legislation to increase transparency and accountability in the legislature. Do you think that's a good step toward what you're asking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are the very things that we're talking about. You know, we'd like to see, like I said, you know, I think there's widespread support across the political spectrum for these kinds of reforms. And I'd like to see more bipartisan action. There are ideas that come, you know, that are great from both political parties. And I just want to see us come together. And this is a great area where we can do so, you know, because it's not controversial and it'll serve the voters of Michigan better.
The governor, as we're having this conversation, has just delivered her State of the State address. Did you hear anything in there that indicates that she's open to what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I heard her call in general for bipartisan action. You know, let's get together and solve the crises that are facing Michigan voters. And like I said, you know, ethics and transparency, it really is it's a foundational kind of process thing, right? And I think, you know, obviously we have COVID, we have infrastructure, you know, all the things that she touched on, which really are practical issues that need to be solved. But I think underlying all of that and allowing the legislators to have kind of the, you know, the ability to work in a confident way with each other, needs to be that they need the voter support. And to get the voter support and confidence, we need more fairness and transparency and ethics in government.
My guests have been Nancy Wong, Executive Director of Voters Not Politicians, and Sue Hammersmith of the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Sue, Nancy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
So much. Such a pleasure.
That's our show for today. I'm April Baird. We'll see you next time. Take care.